So I'm Jenny, and I'm a grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon and Alateen. Thank you. It was my excruciating pain, debilitating loneliness, and personal version of insanity that brought me to Al-Anon. And it is my deepening sense of gratitude that has kept me coming back. It is only because of God's grace working through the 12 steps and God's loving presence revealed in my Al-Anon adult children group years ago that I am still walking the planet today. Al-Anon is a program of miracles and transformation, and I am grateful for how this program has restored me to some degree of sanity, and it has offered me an opportunity to experience the priceless gift of serenity. I have experienced the effects of the cunning, baffling, and powerful nature of alcoholism. It destroys individuals, it destroys families, and it destroys friendships. However, today I know that my higher power, working through the 12 steps and the fellowship of this program, is more powerful than this disease. I believe in the power of the Al-Anon program because of the healing and transformation in my own life and the miracles God has worked in the lives of others who practice the 12 steps. In fact, about 6 months after Phyllis was in the program, I told her that I thought she was a miracle in the program because I just saw the change in her. And I don't know if you can testify to having seen changes in people in your home group or people that you've journeyed with, just seeing, even if they don't see it in themselves at first, sometimes people outside of them can see the changes. Now, the process of recovery is messy, and the movement from awareness to acceptance to action, the theme of this year's gathering, is really how it works. However, if my recovery process could be compared to a ballroom dance routine, my steps would not have led me to be on Dancing with the Stars. That I can say for sure. If someone, they weren't very sexy, let me tell you. If someone had told me before I joined Al-Anon that I would have changed and grown in the ways that I have, I wouldn't have believed them. Before I came to Al-Anon, peace, serenity, and joy felt beyond my reach. I was depressed and suicidal. I was trapped in darkness and pain and had no awareness of the disease and how to be free of its effects. I felt hopeless and helpless, and my life was unmanageable. When I first came to the program, I lived from crisis to crisis. My life was totally unmanageable. I was frozen when it came to my feelings. I was like the walking dead. I was filled with self-hatred and self-pity, and I was at step one and had given up hope because all of the things I had tried to fix in my life and to make myself happier had failed miserably. I was affected by alcoholism, and I needed to recover from its effects. My disease is one of control, trying to control the uncontrollable, other people, events, feelings, situations. Alcoholism is a thief that robbed me of my sanity, my spirituality, my maturity, my joy, my freedom, and more. This disease kept me stuck and bound up with fear, anger, and shame. I grew up surrounded by alcoholism. Denial, fear, and chaos reigned most of the time in my family home. My childhood home was basically a war zone, and I just tried to survive the best I could. My family consists of my parents, my older sister, and my younger sister. We had a couple of my cousins as boarders, and my mom usually babysat four or five other children to bring in some extra money to our home. So I learned not to express my needs very much because there just wasn't much time or energy for what I needed. I had a lot of fear as a child, fear of getting punished with the strap or the wooden spoon, and that happened sometimes, and I didn't know why. Fear of my parents actually carrying through on the threats of splitting up. And because of the paralyzing way fear affected me, I was not very spontaneous as a child. It's really only come to me, I'd say, spontaneity in the last maybe 5-6 years where I can just, woo, you know, kind of, like it's taken me a long, long time to be able to get to this place of freedom. I had a fear as a child of my dad burning down our house because he'd fall asleep drunk on the toilet with a lit cigarette in his hand. And as a child, sometimes I'd sit outside the bathroom. I remember one of my earliest memories is being about 3 years old, two, 3 years old, and crouched down in the hallway waiting for my dad to come out of the bathroom. And the door was partly open, but my dad, you know, had passed out on the toilet. And I didn't want to go wake my mom up because then she'd be pissed off and then the war would start. But I was afraid of, like, peeing my pants. Like, there I was in my pajamas. And I just remember a lot of fear. And we were often told, you know, that we had to obey or else our parents would leave us at the garbage dump. We weren't allowed to cry or we'd get something to cry about, where we were to be seen and not heard. Okay, those are very popular sayings around our home. There was a lot of drinking in our home and in our extended family. So I thought, really, that this was normal. My dad drank daily. My dad played the accordion in a band, and he was sometimes drunk both nights of the weekend. My parents would bring home friends. My dad would go play for cabarets or, you know, dances and stuff, weddings, whatever. And then they'd bring home friends, and they would wake us up at 2 or 3 a.m., my older sister and I. She's a year and a half older than me. And they'd wake us up at 2 or 3 while they ordered in pizza from Villa Pizza. And we were expected to sing one of the two most popular songs. The first one was "In Heaven There Is No Beer." And the other one was "They'll Know We Are Christians By Our Love." So sometimes we sang one and sometimes we sang both. And then we were kind of the entertainment, and then we'd go back to sleep. Like, it was a kind of a, I don't know, middle of the night ritual. My dad was usually a very quiet and peaceful man, and he provided well for our family. However, when my dad was drunk, it was like a switch would flip. I remember being 7 or 8 years old, and my mom and dad had many arguments where my mom threatened to leave my dad, and she told him that particular night, just sleep it off in the truck. And my dad went and got a crowbar, and he threatened to break the windows. And, of course, my mom was afraid of what the neighbors would think, but she told my sister and I to look after one door while she looked after the other door. And then she just let him in. Like, she had hooked the doors from the inside, right, so that he couldn't get in. And then she did let him in. My dad wasn't a violent man, except he would threaten to fight people when he was drinking. And I didn't see that myself, but I know my mom talked about it sometimes. But I always knew how much my dad had to drink by the way his hair was. Like, my dad didn't have to say a word. He could just walk into the room, walk into the house, wherever we were, visiting relatives, it didn't matter. And I would know exactly from the way the bump of my dad's hair was how much he had had to drink. He didn't have to say a word. And that's how sensitive, attuned I was to my dad, because I knew depending on what happened with my dad, then what the dynamics were going to be happening in front of me. As a kid, I did what I could to create peace and to make others happy. I never knew how to treat my dad until I saw how my mom treated him. If my mom gave my dad the silent treatment, I gave him the silent treatment. My mom yelled and screamed at him kind of thing, I criticized him. I thought I needed to be perfect, and as a kid, we were given weekly chores to do, whether it was washing walls, cleaning the bathroom, dusting, whatever, washing the floor. And one of the things that kind of tuned in for me was to do the chores perfectly, because then I would be loved more. My mom's love would kind of be ratcheted up a little bit if I could do things perfectly. And I remember even putting the soup cans in the pantry kind of in perfect ordered with the labels and everything, just to make sure that everything just looked perfectly, hoping to get that praise. So just yearning and hungering to be loved. I learned well the rules of the alcoholic home: don't talk, don't trust, don't feel. So very few people would have guessed at the pain and sadness I was hiding, because I walked around smiling and cheerful most of the time. In high school, I often avoided going home. There were lots of arguments and screaming matches with my mom. In grade 11, my older sister, she became pregnant. She had just turned 17 and had her son. And we were in the same room downstairs. By then, we didn't have boarders anymore. And my younger sister was sleeping in the extra bedroom upstairs. But it was my sister's bed, my nephew's crib, and my bed. All in a single, or like in a room. And so when my nephew got up at 2 o'clock in the morning for a feeding, so did I. And when he got up at 5 in the morning, so did I. And I was just trying to make it through school. And so I'd often end up leaving the room, going into the rumpus room, we call it, and trying to get some sleep on the couch. And during that time, too, is when my grandma on my mom's side, that she died. And she, for me, was always a source of comfort. She always brought in my favorite baking goodies when we visited her home. She'd make the jelly roll, and she'd bring in the, you know, the Long Johns with the coconut on it. And she kind of knew, I felt like she knew me. And she was always very gentle, and she was a stout little German woman. And she had these soft, fleshy arms. And when we used to travel in the car, I used to lay against her arm. My sister would always have me stuck in the middle. She thought she got the good thing by having the door. But I always leaned against my grandma and smelled her perfume, the little bit of perfume she wore, and just kind of snuggled into my grandmother. So she was always kind of a protector for me. And when my mom was sometimes kind of harsh with us when my grandma would visit, I always knew it was going to be, toned down a little bit, because my mom didn't want to kind of erupt so much in front of my grandmother. So she was kind of this protector for me. And so she died when I was in grade 11. So it was a really important year, kind of change for me. And in grade 12, I was voted in as president of our student council. I was the top academic student. I had a couple of trips that I ended up, getting paid for to go to Ottawa, this Terry Fox program and Forum for Young Canadians. And I'm mentioning those things because there were all these achievements that I thought would prove my worthiness. See, because on the inside, I didn't feel like I was worthy. I didn't feel like I was worthy of love, of attention, of care. And I wasn't a good athlete. I wasn't a good musician, although my parents did have me take accordion lessons when I was a kid. But let me tell you, it's not a very popular instrument unless you're Frankie Yankovic or part of Great Big Sea, maybe. And so for me, academics was where it was at for me, and being in a leadership position at school. And I never dated throughout high school. Like I've always been, since about grade 3, 4, I've been overweight. And so I always felt like less than, you know, no one asked me out for a date. And one time I remember asking my friend's boyfriend, who had been a friend of mine for many years as well. And I said, Greg, like, how come nobody ever asks me out? Like, what is it about me that's, you know, he just said, Jenny, you always act like you don't need anybody. And I thought, oh, yeah, okay. So when I played ringette, but I was always riding the bench the most. I was the worst skater on the team. So, but there was one time when I came home from a game. I arrived home, and my older sister was at home with her son, and my younger sister was asleep in her room, I think. Okay, and I walked in, and there was my dad, running naked from the bedroom to the bathroom and back again. And I kind of, like, he didn't see me. He didn't realize that I was there. And I could smell my dad had lost control of his bowels. He had been home that night and drinking and had some friends over, whatever. And I could smell the vomit from downstairs. And I don't know who all had been there. I had been away for a number of hours. My mom had gone to play bingo at our church. And I knew where she was, having pizza with her friends. So I went and I said to her, trying to do it as I left the house, because I know my older sister was afraid downstairs with her son. You know, my dad didn't even know she was home, but she just slipped downstairs. So I went down, talked to her, and I said, I'll go get mom. And so I tried to tell my mom, like, we need you to come home. And she's all like, this is my only night out of the week. I'm saying, Mom, we need you to come home. And so, you know, I remember just not being able to talk about it in front of her friends, because how do you say what the truth is? And so I learned to never talk about my fears, my embarrassment, shame or guilt. I stuffed a lot. And my family went to church every Sunday, and I felt like such a phony, because I thought if people only knew what had gone on behind closed doors just a few hours earlier, like my mom and my dad would come home after midnight, like I said, 2 or 3 in the morning, and then they'd argue, threaten divorce, and at 10 a.m. there'd we all be standing in the back pew of the church. And, you know, when it happened Sunday, and my dad was still smelling, you know, either from rye or from, you know, from beer right beside me. And I know that I just felt like a phony on the inside. I felt very alone. I was often told by my mom that I was the black sheep of the family. There wasn't a lot of affection in our home. I tried to feel important and valuable by trying to make other people happy, by anticipating and filling their needs. Thought I could avoid conflicts, you know, try to be the peacemaker all the time. And this kept me very unaware of my own needs. you know, I kind of saw myself, I think when I look back now, that I was kind of like the female version of Atlas, you know, just carrying the weight of the world on my shoulder. And still today, I know I've changed a little bit, is I could be at a table where there's eight people at a rectangular table, and I could notice, I'm at this end, and I could notice at the far end on the opposite end that someone is missing their fork. Like, that's how tuned in I am to other people's needs, and there could be a potential problem there, so I better anticipate the need and get it filled. And I still kind of, the odd time when I'm not working my program so well and kind of keeping my focus more on myself, I can still get into that kind of behavior of, you know, trying to fix problems before they even really exist, or letting someone else take care of whatever their need is by asking the server for a fork, for goodness sake. And so in my third year university, I slipped into a depression. I felt very abandoned and alone. My marks slid, which had been kind of my, you know, saving grace. I felt out of control. I was suicidal. I had thought of lots of creative ways to end my life. I went on a young person's retreat, a young Christian retreat. And while I was there, there was a priest that had been brought in to speak about reconciliation, about the sacrament of confession, reconciliation. And while I was there, I had cried most of the weekend. And I waited to see this guy. Some other priest had been brought in, but I wanted to see the one who had spoken. And I went to see him. I waited. I went in to see him, and I just told him that I, you know, didn't like who I was, and I was asking for forgiveness because I had images of just wanting to choke my parents. I was tired of all the arguing and stuff, and I said, I don't want to be this person, but I don't know how to be different. And he just said to me, Jenny, by any chance, does somebody in your family have a drinking problem? And I had not said one word about alcohol. And I just talked about conflict or whatever. And he just said, does someone have a drinking problem? And I said, as a matter of fact, they do. And then I revealed a little bit. And he said, how about for your penance, you go to an Al-Anon meeting by the end of next week? And I agreed. And so I waited and waited. And finally, Friday of the next week, I got my keister to a meeting. And lo and behold, who was sitting at the table was him. And still now today I see him. I see him at roundups, and I see him, you know, I see him around, and he's a very safe place for me. I tell him I talk about you all the time without necessarily naming you. And pardon me. So my home group soon became the Al-Anon Adult Children Group, which we used to meet at Burns Hanley in Regina. I don't know if some of you remember that old rickety building that has since been torn down. But there were many meetings that were held in that place. I went to two or three adult children meetings a week. I cried a lot. I received a lot of hugs. Al-Anon felt very safe for me. I then went through an outpatient treatment program, and it helped me to understand the disease. But my depression, again, was so strong and low, like I was so low, that the person there who was kind of helping me out recommended that I go on antidepressants for a while. So I'd gone to see a psychiatrist, and for about 6 months, 8 months or so in there, I was on antidepressants, and it kind of helped me through my lowest point. I don't recommend it for everybody, but it's part of my story. I then moved out on my own. I had a hard time trusting my own perceptions of what was real and what was and what wasn't. And one night when I was living in the basement suite where, you know, I'd started to live, I just felt like I was so totally in a different zone. And I called up one of my friends and I said, this is how I'm feeling. Like, I'm just feeling like, ugh. Like, I just can't be in touch with reality here. And like, I was just breaking through so much denial kind of all at once. And just really questioning things. And he just said to me, Jenny, he said, go outside and hug a tree. I thought, ooh, am I hearing you right? Like, did I call the right person here? And he just said, Jenny, go outside and hug a tree and you will be grounded. He said, just hug that tree like you've never hugged anything before. And he said, stay there as long as you need to. And it was nighttime. I went outside and I can remember, like, I just hugged the tree and felt the bark against my face. And I thought, yeah, I just needed to be rooted somewhere, because I didn't know what was up, what was down, what was true, what wasn't. I was just really, really struggling. I began to work the steps and practice the slogans, and I clung to the Serenity Prayer. At first, my list of all the things that I could not change was pretty short. There were very few things on there. But my list of things that I thought I could change, I had to sharpen the pencil a few times. And now gratefully, that has switched around. I have a little more wisdom today. So I joined a step group, and I had three sponsors. They were like my tri. I called them the Golden Girls. And I needed to learn to trust others, to open up and share the feelings that I had bottled up for so long. I also needed to learn to trust God, and that was difficult for me to do. I grew up thinking that I needed to be perfect, whatever that was, and it was always changing. Or else God wouldn't love me, and in fact, I could expect God's punishment. And often it was the waving of the finger at home, like, God's going to know what you did. So if I ever, you know, hurt myself in some way, stubbed my toe, when I was a little kid, I cut my finger on some glass. We had to go to the hospital and get stitches. It was like, I must have done something wrong because God's punishing me. And I carried that with me for a long, long time. And my one prayer as a young child was that that my dad would quit drinking so that we wouldn't have as many fights in our family and my family would stay together. And that prayer was never answered. And so I thought, well, there must be something wrong with me, because it was a fairly good prayer, I thought. I was asking for a good thing and it was never answered. So I thought, you know, God, I'm not lovable enough, or I'm not up to God's standards. So today I believe that God was always with me. And that God desired peace, trust, and healing for my family while I was growing up. And when this disease rears its ugly, powerful head, God's grace is blocked. In chapter 4 of the book, Discovering Choices, it says, all the love in the world could not stop the disease from getting worse. So until I joined Al-Anon and immersed myself in the tools of the program, attending meetings, working the steps, practicing the slogans, reading conference-approved literature, and sharing with my sponsors, I wasn't really a free person. I wasn't aware that I had choices in the same way that I do today. I craved to experience joy. My boundaries were practically non-existent, especially emotional ones. I didn't trust others, so I didn't know how to give and receive freely, and I certainly wasn't living in the present. I was so filled with anger and regret about the past, and I lived in a lot of fear of the future. And my image about my anger was, I was afraid to tap into my anger. I knew I was angry, like I could just react like in a big way over some small insignificant thing. But my image was, I don't know, I got it from when I was a kid. You know how clowns pull those cloths out of their... I was afraid if I kind of tapped into that, I didn't know where it would end. It was like one thing was going to be attached to the other, to the next. And I didn't know. So I was afraid to tap into my anger. I wanted to control everything and everybody around me because I felt so out of control on the inside. I judged people constantly. There was constant criticism going on. Even if I didn't say it out loud all the time, because I didn't want to be seen as a judgmental person, I wanted people to like me. And so I didn't always say it, but it helped myself feel better. It's like if I could pull people down, then somehow I would think that I would be more important. I constantly reacted to other people and gave my power over. I saw that other people in the program could laugh, were hopeful, and could trust in God and each other. And I wanted what they had. And in order to get there, I needed to get through all the years of emotions that I had stored up. A lot of pain, confusion, anger, fear, resentment, and guilt. And as I grew in wisdom, I learned that it takes time to heal from the devastating effects of alcoholism. And my spiritual awakening did not happen overnight. It happened one day at a time, like I was told it would when I came through the doors of Al-Anon. People in the program loved me before I could love myself. And I learned about a loving, patient, forgiving, and accepting God through this loving, patient, forgiving, and accepting 12-step program. When I first came to Al-Anon, I wanted the drive-through service. That wouldn't take much time. Yeah. And I wanted someone to bundle up all the gifts of the program, and I just kept and just hand it over to me. I wanted, you know, like I said, the accelerated program. In my own grandiosity, yeah, I thought I could, you know, do this faster than everybody else. I didn't say that out loud again. It was all on the inside. And that I would pass this test with flying colors or something. And I remember being in the adult children meetings, and there was one guy, we went for coffee afterwards. There was a group of us that would often go for coffee after, he said to me, I walked up to the table and said, so where's your banner? And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, your Miss Al-Anon banner. And I thought, oh my God, like, is that how I'm coming across? And so we kind of laughed about it. I still see him around once in a while, and he still teases me about being involved in service now and stuff. But I realized I was so hungry to be relieved of my pain. And I so wanted to connect and belong and have friends, people that I could trust, people that I could that I could care about and they could care about me and be free to be myself. But I didn't know who I was. So I was just yearning to learn a lot. And for me, I know that the real source of my transformation in my recovery is my changed relationship with my higher power. Today, I trust my higher power in so many ways, on so many levels, and this relationship is the basis of the freedom, power, and serenity that I have in my life today. The spiritual principles contained in the 12 steps have expanded my awareness and have helped me to accept my past more and to accept who I am today. They have also helped me to take the actions that I never thought were possible. When I choose to practice steps 1, 2, and 3, I grow in faith and trust in my higher power, who is gentle with me, who is gracious and loving. And steps 1, 2, and 3 taught me and continue to teach me how to surrender my will and my life into God's care. Choosing to surrender my illusion of control brings me a deeper peace and a deeper connection with myself because it brings my focus back to the reality of what I do have the power to change and to create, and that is a meaningful life for myself. Surrender and freedom have come came from learning the three C's in Al-Anon, that I didn't cause alcoholism, I can't control it, and I can't cure it. Sometimes I still slip into thinking that I can. My behavior reveals that. So that's why I need to keep coming back, because I can slip into that at any time. Discovering that I'm not responsible for another person's happiness, the alcoholics, or anyone else in my life was a huge breakthrough for me. The relationship I still have the most difficulty with is my relationship with my mother. One of the fears that used to cause me a lot of difficulty was that my mother would die feeling that she wasn't loved by me. And I need to constantly be reminded that I can be loving towards my mother. However, I cannot control how she feels, whether she feels loved by me or not. Because when I was a kid, it felt like that picture of what it meant to love her constantly changed, like her interpretation. So I could, like, you know, be dancing around doing all these different things, and then the next day the definition of loving her kind of changed. And so today I'm free of that fear to a large degree. Again, I can slip back into that, but I know that I can choose to be a loving person to my mom, and in the end, I have no control over whether she feels loved by me. And that's a huge shift. That was a huge shift for me in my recovery. Not just with my mom, but that's a relationship that I still have the most difficulty with. The first three steps remind me to let others experience the results of their choices and decisions, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Like me not trying to be a peacemaker between my sisters and my mom when they have conflict, which is often a temptation for me. They have the right to determine the type of relationships they want in their lives. My sisters and my mom and I were making pierogies last Friday, and my younger sister had the audacity to tell my mom that she thinks she could downsize from 3 freezers to 2 freezers. So my mother then informed my sister that I don't tell you what to do in your house, and I'd appreciate it that you don't tell me what to do in mine. And I thought, woo, yeah, mom. And then I reminded myself, I was thinking that. I just didn't say it. I was thinking exactly what my sister was thinking, but I just, okay, Jenny, just don't, like, I've learned. I can think all kinds of things. The program has taught me it's not my business. It stops here. It stops here. It's not my business. So the first, pardon me, I need to trust that my family members have their own higher power who is caring for them and that it isn't me. I am not God in anybody else's life. I have to say that I still find it most difficult to detach when I know there are children who are affected by this illness. Like when I see my little niece and nephew, my nephew's children, I'm sorry, them being affected. And even my nephew, my older sister's son, she ended up marrying the father of her son, and then they got married and had a second son. And when the one who was born when my sister was a teenager, I went over to their home one time, and my nephew said to me, he was like 5 years old, and his dad went in, opened up the pantry thing, and my nephew said to me, Auntie Jenny, do you want a shot of Crown Royal? And I thought, like, I could have just burst out crying right there. I thought, like, he knew the lingo. I couldn't have even read the scripty writing on the bottle. But my nephew knew enough that, you know, so obviously there was a lot more drinking going on in their home than I even knew about, which I, of course, I know is part of the disease. So I do have a hard time letting go when it comes to children. One of my go-to slogans is to let go and let God. It summarizes for me the essentials of steps one, two, and three, and helps me to change my actions, even if that means just stopping doing something. When I choose to let go of expectations of others, I have fewer resentments. When I choose to let go of doing things the way they have always been done, I am more open to possibilities. And when I choose to let go of taking other people's inventories, I'm able to keep more of my priceless gift of serenity instead of handing it over to somebody else. And the benefits of choosing to let go of what I cannot change continue to ripple out in my life. The let go part of the prayer, of praying the slogan, helps me to trust that God will work things out in God's time. I don't have to know the solutions right away. I just need to be willing to trust the process and be patient. And this is where acceptance plays a significant part in my recovery. And I used to suffer from whiffitis. What if this? What if that? What if the other thing? And I would give my power away by catastrophizing over what might never come to be. And after my husband's stroke 4 years ago, I suffered from whiffitis and needed to keep surrendering my fear that I could be a widow. That I could be a widow sooner than I dreamed of being. The slogan, live and let live, also reminds me to keep the focus on me and surrender to God. Live and let live helps me to keep my boundaries in perspective. And when I cross someone else's boundaries, I need to make amends and change my behavior. Like sometimes trying to tell my husband what I think is best for him, what he should wear, what he should eat, how long he should sleep, or whatever it is. Sometimes I still slip into that. And I'm grateful. One of the reasons I married my husband was because he has a very strong, he's not in the program, but he has a very strong personality. He was trained as a psychiatric nurse, and he's got good communication skills overall. And so, you know, he's very strong about maintaining his own boundaries and kind of lets me know when I'm crossing into his. Over the years, I've learned to detach with love from the people around me more of the time. Early on in the program, I detached with anger because I hadn't learned how to separate the disease from the person. I eventually learned that the unrecovered people in my life were not doing things to me to deliberately hurt me. Their behavior reflected more their own pain and their struggles with this disease. I still react sometimes, but I move more quickly to acceptance. And the program has taught me to mind my own business and take responsibility for myself. Early on in the program, I wondered what I was going to do with all the extra time if I didn't have to try to control other people's lives. And if I wasn't responsible for healing all of the pain in the world, I soon found out that the 12 steps recommended that I do a few things with all of this extra time, like doing a fearless and searching inventory in step four. And steps four and five have helped me to be able to recognize and accept who I am and the truth about myself. Steps four and five helped me to gain freedom and power. Some layers of blindness to my patterns, which hurt myself and others, were removed. I had to come clean about how manipulative I was, my judgment of others, my perfectionism, my dishonesty, my controlling, and the shortcoming list of the inventory list can go on. And it was a challenge for me to see some of my good attributes, being a caring listener, being organized, having some leadership skills, following through on commitments, and the asset side of the inventory list can go on as well. I also experienced the unconditional love of my higher power through the people who heard my step fives over the years. They gently have reminded me that I did the best with what I had and knew growing up. They told me that the behavior patterns I learned growing up in an alcoholic home helped me to survive. But they were not serving me now and were no longer necessary for me since I was learning a new way of living in the program. It's like I had to accept myself at all these different stages in my life in order to say, Jenny, you did the best job you could when you were a kid. You did the best job you could when you were a teenager. Like all of these, you know, behaviors that I learned that as an adult were causing me pain, I needed to embrace them and I needed to forgive myself for the harm that I had caused. I was always expecting or waiting for God's 2x4 to teach, to help me stop doing the things that were hurting, things that I was doing that were hurting other people. Instead, the program showed me that true spiritual transformation happens when safety, when love, and when acceptance are present. When I shared my defects of character at meetings, instead of judging me, people understood that I needed to be hugged and told to be gentle with myself, and that if I kept coming back and reading the literature and living the 12 steps, that with the help of my higher power, things would change. I came to learn that steps 6 and 7 are not like a sugaring treatment where my shortcomings are just ripped away all at once. I just needed to become willing for God to remove them and let God work the miracle of change. Because I still want to tell God even how I should change and in what way, at what rate, and For these defects that have let go, I'm not sure that I can tell you exactly when and how they happened. God seems to provide the opportunities for me to feel and act in a different way once I have the readiness to let go of a destructive pattern in some way. I was on a retreat two years ago, and the retreat leader invited those of us who were there to write a letter to one of our character defects and let that character defect know that thank you for being a part of my life for a certain amount of time, but you can basically hit the road, Jack. I don't need you anymore because you're still causing harm in my life. And it was a real healing opportunity. I actually did it for a couple of my, you know, perfectionism was the one that I chose first because it has caused so much stress for me and so much judgment for me of myself. And then, of course, it diffuses into other people as well. The process of becoming aware, accepting what was and what is, and then choosing to act differently helped me to grow and change into more of the person that I've wanted to become. I'm less like that, you know, the story of the, there's a story of the guy who cleans his fish tank and he moves the fish from the tank, how does it go, from the fish tank into the bathtub, and the fish still goes around in the small little area, like it doesn't know there's more area. For me, it's like I just kind of saw this small world, like I didn't see that I could expand beyond it for a long time in my life. And now I see possibilities. I'm no longer wanting to limit God. It's like, God, I have no idea where you're leading me. I don't know why this is happening and that's happening. But now today I can say I feel like the way is being prepared for me. The way is being prepared, and I don't even know how that's happening or where it's happening. But now sometimes when I look back, I can say, okay, now I see. Like, how did all these people and situations and decisions kind of like all come together that I'm now in this place? And so that's how my faith in God has really changed, that I trust God even with the more of the details of my life, you know, surrendering not just the big things, but the little things. So the humility and integrity needed to practice these steps has helped me to mature in many ways and helped me to grow in love for myself, things that were foreign to me before I began to live the 12 steps. I know that most of life's greatest gifts do not have a price tag, and they do not come cheaply. In order to be genuine, they need to be gained through honesty and patience and received gratefully from God. Practicing steps 8 and 9, making my list and making amends, was very freeing for me. The people I hurt most in my life were my family members, and my dad refused to hear my step 9 when he was alive. So I've done a few step 9s at my dad's graveside. As I've had things revealed to me about how I treated my dad, some memories have come back as more healing has happened. When I go out for Father's Day or on his birthday or, you know, at Christmas time or whenever, you know, often it's my mom and my sisters and I, we all go out together, but sometimes I just go out on my own. And I've gone out, taken my little folk fest chair, and I sit out there, and I've written and shared a step 9 with my dad, making amends to him. My amends to him also has been to treat the alcoholics who cross my path with understanding and compassion, something I didn't have a lot of when before my dad died. The understanding and compassion that I wish I had had for him in my teenage years and early 20s. People in the program told me not to forget myself on my amends list. I needed to forgive myself for all the harm I had caused to myself over the years. One of the biggies for me was forgiving myself for being in a relationship with an unrecovered alcoholic for 4 years after swearing that it would never happen to me. Are those familiar words for anyone? Because I had been in the program for 10 years before I met him. And I was attracted to his sense of humor, and he was involved in his church with his youth group, and he was becoming a teacher, and there were all these check, check, check things for me that kind of attracted me to him, and I didn't see it. I was in denial. I didn't see it. And I accepted unacceptable behavior from him. I became insane trying to control him, his drinking, his behavior, and his feelings for me. And I was finally able to detach from him. And I'm grateful for the love and support that I had in the program. People just loved me when I, you know, swore I wouldn't talk to him again, and then 3 days later I'd be calling him, or I'd stop by his house or whatever. I was doing this insane behavior, like I made all these promises and I wouldn't keep them to myself. And people just nodded their head, hugged me. Jenny, you know, just one day at a time, sometimes an hour at a time. And I had a lot of good people in my life. My daily amends to myself is to try to treat myself with love and respect. By listening to myself and honoring my own needs and preferences, taking care of my health, accepting myself when I don't make the best choices, and investing in my relationships with my friends and family. My amends to myself involve the many ways I try to love and care for myself that bring joy, freedom, and wholeness. So when I choose to, doing daily inventories at the end of the day, and I admit I, you know, sometimes don't do them, but when I do them, they help me to surrender and make amends before my character defects grow too deep and make roots again. And also, I don't like sleepless nights anymore. I don't know about you, but for me now, if I don't make that amend before I go to sleep, you know, make the phone call or whatever, or, you know, I've never made an amend by a text or whatever. Maybe I would if it was 2 a.m. or something and just say, I'll connect with you in the morning, but for now I need to say this. But I like my sleep, and when I don't have peace of mind because I know I haven't treated someone well, I need to make that amend. And the slogans one day at a time and just for today have helped me more to be present to the present. It is rare now for me to slip back in regret for the past. More often I feel overwhelmed by fear of the future. For me, my friends, my family, financial stability, my health, the environment, world peace, you get the picture? Fears take hold when I've spent too much time watching the news and not enough time practicing step 11, having prayerful connection with my higher power. I have found that as I live in gratitude, focusing on the gift of today, that miracles happen in my life. And my capacity for joy has definitely increased as a result of living the 12 steps. I feel like I have a reservoir of joy where there only used to be a little thimbleful for me to tap into. And there is a great deal of dignity to be found in the humility of asking for my higher power's help. I no longer feel as if I do anything alone, since my higher power is both with me and within me at all times. Also, when I'm heading into a challenging situation, whatever that is, I sometimes visualize my Al-Anon friends on either flank, and I imagine them kind of walking with me, just their caring, their spirit, their love, their encouragement, their hope, kind of walking with me into whatever situation that I'm heading into, that I'm never alone in this program, even physically if they're not there with me. And so how God works today in my life is a mystery to me exactly, but I do have a sense, and it's a mystery that I'm more comfortable with today, you know, not knowing how God is going to work things out, but trusting that God is with me always. In the Al-Anon book, Having Had a Spiritual Awakening, one person describes God as working in his or her life like how he or she understood electricity. Imagine a switch being flipped open to the power of God. But if the switch isn't flipped, that you're open to it, it's not going to be present in your life. And that made sense to me early on in the program when I read that. The 12 steps do not come with a problem-free or suffering-free guarantee. I think early on in the program, I thought Al-Anon was going to be like a vaccine. And be like, I was going to be like a problem-free vaccine. You know, I wouldn't have any more problems in my life. I definitely have fewer because I'm not creating them. I'm not creating the drama. I'm not creating as many situations where I need to go and make amends and kind of have that struggle and that pain and try to restore relationships. A lot of that has been done already today. And so now I'm just freer to kind of live my life today. So surrendering and acceptance have certainly lessened the pain in my life and have helped me to face my challenges. Step 12 says that having had a spiritual awakening, we try to carry this message to others. And in Al-Anon's literature describes service work as gratitude in action. The great thing about service in Al-Anon is that there are a lot of choices about how we want to give back and how I want to, in particular, want to give back to the fellowship that saved my life. So how I want to express my gratitude is up to me. And I've chosen different positions throughout the years. I've learned how to live out the spiritual principles of trust, of unity, of equality, of responsibility, and love while working together with others for a common purpose. My service work in Al-Anon started when I set up chairs and chaired meetings at my Al-Anon adult children meeting in my home group for over 27 years, Serenity on Saturday. Sometimes it's hard to pin down exactly when my attitude changed or when I learned something while doing service work. Our literature tells us that different service roles encourage self-discovery and personal growth. And what I do know is that I have been stretched while serving as an Al-Anon member. I'm only going to touch on a couple of things, but when I was an Alateen sponsor years ago with Sharon H. from, she's now up in PA, but we were Alateen sponsors in Regina together, and it triggered for me some memories from my childhood and helped me to grow, heal of some of the resentments for hurt done to me and some dreams and some of my lost childhood. I grew in compassion for myself during that time and the amazement of the coping skills that I had developed to survive. Why? Because I saw these kids, the kids in the Alateen group, living it out. In July of 2013, I attended the International Convention. It's not service work, but I went to the Al-Anon International Convention in Vancouver, and I wanted to meet our bigger Al-Anon family, and I had a profound spiritual experience there that at the end of one of the sessions, we all gathered holding hands, and we said the Al-Anon Declaration. We also prayed the Serenity Prayer, but here we said the Al-Anon Declaration twice, once while facing inwards, and then we all turned around and faced outwards to the world. And it was like for all the people who are still out there suffering, like I had been before I got to the doors, it's like I want to keep giving back to strengthen our family so that other people who come to hear about our program can also have hope and healing in their life from the effects of this disease. So, you know, I've served in different positions and now I'm going to soon be ending my time as the delegate for the province. And so, you know, I am grateful for all the growing that has happened for me during this time. And one incident actually happened here. I remembered it when I was coming in, happened here at this hotel. It was under renovations when we had an assembly here. I think it was 2 years ago now. I'm not sure, a year and a half. I can't remember the exact thing. But we were set up, and then I had put my delegate love gifts out on the table and kind of did all my setting up of all my stuff. And then I went to go to the early bird meeting. And when I went to go in the room to the meeting, someone said, well, it was Barbell was chairing the meeting. She's a former delegate. And she said, oh, Jenny, sorry, fire regulations, you can't come in. And I thought, what's going on? And what came through my mind was, but I'm the delegate. I should be able to. You see, like it can just happen just like that. I thought, what are you talking about? Like that's what was going on. I didn't say it out loud. And then I just thought, Jenny, but you're the delegate. And you're serving, and you can start up a meeting back in the other room for anybody else. It showed me that I needed the meeting, which I knew I needed the meeting. But all of a sudden, my thinking was like right away, like, oh, my goodness, Jenny, aren't you full of yourself? And then I just had to say, God, like, help me. So I came back into the room, and I knocked on the door again, and I said, if anybody, because the hotel was under renovations, so the room we thought we'd have, we couldn't have. So we had this smaller room. I said, if anybody else comes to this door, please send them. I'm going to start another meeting. And there ended up being like five or six of us who ended up meeting and had our own small meeting in the big room. And, you know, but so I've had to learn over the last 3 years some humility over things that I didn't know. I had to ask for help. I've had lots of support from people. I've met so many family members. Like I've traveled to Nipawin and Weyburn and Swift Current and Esterhazy and Assiniboia and like I've been at Lloydminster. Like I've been invited all over the place. Prince Albert. I've been up here in Saskatoon, Regina. Like I've been invited all over the place in order to try to help strengthen the Al-Anon family. And it's been a real honor and gift for me to do that. And I've learned lots. And the thing I'm most grateful for is how many people I've met that are trying to improve their lives and have healing and hope from this program. So my gratitude has deepened and the blessings have been abundant, including loving, laughing, and growing together with others and healing as we go along. I've been married to my husband, Ryan, for 11 years now. And my marriage is a great source of joy for me. We dated for 2 years and were engaged for a year before we got married. And without the program, I wouldn't have been able to say yes to my husband because I would have been so afraid to try to commit to someone and lose myself in that marriage, like lose who Jenny is. And because we are both works in progress, our marriage is a work in progress. We have our challenges, and I'm grateful that I have the program to help me do my part. I went through a really low point 9 years ago. I was angry, grieving some changes that had happened. I had voice problems. You've heard me cough a little bit tonight. But I was hired to teach stuff that I now no longer believed in. And with integrity, I couldn't teach anymore. Like, I believe there's a physical issue for my throat, but I know that ultimately my naturopath that I went to see about my problems with my throat, she said to me, well, Jenny, have you ever heard of the energy chakras? And I said, no, I have no idea, but she'd been trained in Eastern medicine. And she said, well, go home and look it up. And the throat chakra, I guess, with this system, is about speaking your spiritual truth. And I was having a very difficult time doing that. And I ended up surrendering my contract as a teacher in the Regina Catholic school system. And I just said, God, I give it over to you. My health comes before anything else. And so now I substitute teach, and I lead retreats for high school students in Regina. And but it was a big surrendering for me because, you know, I don't have a health plan under that thing. I don't, you know, I'm not pensionable in the same way that I was. I still have some students that I stay in contact with, and that's kind of what I miss the most are my relationships with my students. I loved what I was doing, but I just couldn't do it in that way anymore. And I had to surrender. And it was because of this program, because spiritually my understanding of God had grown and changed so much. It wasn't limited anymore by the religious tradition that I had grown up in. And so I just want to say a little bit about my relationship with my sponsor who died almost 4 years, well, 5 years ago now. She taught me a lot about love and trust. And in some sense, she was like a mom to me. And I know that she shared with me that I was like a daughter to her. But we shared with each other as equals. And she had such spontaneity and spirit. That's what attracted me to her, to invite her to be my sponsor to begin with. And she said yes. And, you know, 3 days after she was in British Columbia, she was retired and she was wintering in BC. And she called me up and said, Jenny, results came back that, you know, I have cancer in my gallbladder and my pancreas. And they're not giving me much, you know, I'll maybe have a few months. And within 3 days, I was on the plane out there. And then she came home a few months later, and she's getting treatment out there. And I was able to journey with her as she died. And, you know, just when I would say still, even more than my husband, she is the person who knows me the deepest. And she hasn't even been here for 5 years. But the real journey of recovery that happened with her and the exploration of who I am and my faith and all kinds of things happened during my friendship with her. And so I can't speak strongly enough about the importance of sponsors in my life. I mean, I have another sponsor now, but that had been a relationship for 20 years. Today I have choices about who and what and how to grieve. And Al-Anon has taught me how to grieve at the death of my former sponsor and other people in my life. So that I'm not paralyzed anymore by my accumulated pain and anger and sadness about these losses. I've learned that if I don't feel my grief and walk through it, then I will stay stuck in it. And a few years ago, there were 8 of us who journeyed through the book, the Al-Anon book, Opening Our Hearts, Transforming Our Losses. And it helped me to grieve many of the losses and dreams in my life, including the loss of not being a mother. And Linda, my sponsor for 20 years, she used to tell me on Mother's Day, she'd call me up every Mother's Day, and or if I didn't call her first, but in the phone call to each other, she'd say, Jenny, you are one of the best mothers I know who never had children. And because I would always grieve that I hadn't had my own kids. And but she honored the qualities of a mom, so she was a real gift to me. I tried not to avoid feelings today. Instead, I try to let them teach me more about myself. I realize that having feelings is not a choice, but how I choose to deal with those feelings is a choice. When I feel vulnerable and afraid or I'm feeling some shame, I tend to want to isolate. I know that the most healing and loving thing for me then is to share my feelings with someone, especially my sponsor, who I know will support me and guide me by giving me gentle and loving feedback. And thanks to my sponsor of 20 years who died, I was able to start healing in one of the areas of my recovery that has been the most difficult to because of a lot of shame. And I wasn't lucky enough for the clock to buzz yet, but it might. It's because it's the area of sexuality, right? And so I often share that I had to learn that having an orgasm was not the answer to all of my problems. That I still get scared of feelings when it comes to the area of sexuality. I was often scared of rejection, you know, as I was growing up. When I was young, I played doctor as a kid, you know, with kids that my mom babysat. You know, we were all around the same age, you know, 3, 4, 5. Like, I have memories of that kind of stuff. But felt very ashamed about that, of doing any kind of exploration or, you know, because, of course, I wasn't going to ask any questions about that. When I was making my parents' bed one time, I found pornography in between my parents' mattresses. And then, of course, other times when I made the bed, you know, explored that a little bit and felt shame through all of that, too. But there wasn't the openness and honesty in my family to be able to actually ask questions. Like, what is it, you know, what is sex? What, there were lots of jokes about sex in my family, especially when there was a lot of drinking going on. And it was almost like we were expected to know the stuff. Like, what does that mean? Or what would that look like? Or how would somebody feel? Or, you know, like, you're expected to know it. But there wasn't any actual honest, open discussion that happened around it. When I was in grade 12 and desperately wanted a boyfriend, a few guy friends of mine, and some of them were dating a couple of my girlfriends, they came to pick me up because we were all going to the park to play football. And my mom came, and she knew these guys too, because they'd been at our house lots of times, and some of them I went to elementary school with. And my mom stood at the top of the stairs, and she said, "Now, don't you boys touch my Jenny, because I don't want her getting pregnant." Well, honestly, as a 17-year-old, like, I swear I could have just into a hole there. But of course, my mom, which I didn't really think about until I was in recovery, was afraid that same thing would happen to me as what happened to my sister, you know, and having the responsibility. I mean, they parented my sister's son for, you know, for a while my sister was still finishing school. You know, I felt, you know, growing up, felt scared of my body, felt feelings of being aroused. I didn't know the facts about sexuality. I was often attracted to unavailable men who were gay, men who were committed in other relationships, priests, of course, and because they were spiritual, okay? They were spiritual and unavailable. That makes sense, okay? To me, it did. Today in marriage, I invite God into my sexual intimacy, but I say I don't stop to pray right in the middle because it might spoil the mood. but I do try to ask for God's help. And a lot of that is because, you know, my husband had a stroke and he lost, he still doesn't have full feeling in his hand. He has pain in his shoulder. His foot is like, he can't move like he used to. Things have changed for him. He's had losses about his own power, his own ability. His body has changed. His feelings have changed. And it's like we needed to relearn some things together. And I needed to ask God into that, to have patience, to have openness, to have vulnerability myself, to invite him to be vulnerable with me, because he kind of wanted to just shut right down. And I just said to him, like, I don't want to just be your roommate. I want to have the fullness of an intimate relationship, emotionally, spiritually, psychologically, for us to share things together, physically, sexually. I want it all. And so can we work together in order to keep that open? And it's difficult. Okay, there we go. So I just want to say that there's still some areas in my life where I still have a lot of work to do. I'm the heaviest I've ever been. I've had some pain in my chest in the last couple of months and across my arm. And I went to go, it had been 7 years since I'd had a full physical. Now, for some of you, that might not seem like a big deal, but I didn't realize it had taken that long. And I lost track of time in terms of taking care of myself. I thought I was doing a good job. So I know I still need to keep coming back to this program, because some ways, even when I think I'm doing well, and in a lot of areas of my life I am, but in some areas I'm not. And so I've sat in front of the computer way more than I've ever wanted to, having to do a lot of computer work in the last few years. And I've been too sedentary. I haven't made good choices for myself in terms of my physical physical health. And so, you know, when my time is done as delegate at the end of this year, and it doesn't have to wait till then, it can start tomorrow, and it's already started, but I need to shift things in order to take care of, you know, to take care of myself. And because self-love, I know, is a big part of this program. And before this program, I didn't think I was worth it. But today I know that I am. Thanks to you.